This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I have a couple of nice little short stories for you. It's good to be back on the air. And so I'll give you a moment to get settled, and I'll be right back. Stay tuned. And I'm back. This is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here at 104.3 and KTOO. And my first story is by wonderful author Saki. It's called Morvira. The Olympic Toy Emporium occupied a conspicuous frontage in an important West End street. It was happily named Toy Emporium, because one would never have dreamed of according it the familiar and yet pulse-quickening name of Toy Shop. There was an air of cold splendor and elaborate failure about the wares that were set out in its ample windows. They were the sort of toys that a tired shop assistant displays and explains at Christmas time to exclamatory parents and bored, silent children. The animal toys looked more like a natural history models than the comfortable, sympathetic companions that one would wish at a certain age to take to bed with one and to smuggle into the bathroom. The mechanical toys incessantly did things that no one could want a toy to do more than a half dozen times in its lifetime. It was a merciful reflection that in any right-minded nursery, the lifetime would certainly be short. Prominent among the elegantly dressed dolls that filled an entire section of the window frontage was a large, hobble-skirted lady in a confection of peach-colored velvet, elaborately set off with leopard skin accessories. If one may use such a conveniently comprehensive word in describing an intricate feminine toilette. She lacked nothing that is to be found in a carefully detailed fashion plate. In fact, she might be said to have something more than the average fashion plate female possesses. In place of a vacant, expressionless stare, she had character in her face. It must be admitted that it was bad character, cold, hostile, inquisitorial, with a sinister lowering of one eyebrow and a merciless hardness about the corners of the mouth. One might have imagined histories about her by the hour, histories in which unworthy ambition, the desire for money, and an entire absence of all decent feeling would play a conspicuous part. As a matter of fact, she was not without her judges and biographers, even in this shop window stage of her career. Emmeline, aged 10, and Bert, aged 7, had halted on the way from their obscure back street to the minnow-stocked water of St. James's Park and were critically examining the hobble-skirted doll and dissecting her character in no very tolerant spirit. There is probably a latent hostility between the necessarily underclad and the unnecessarily overdressed, but a little kindness and good fellowship on the part of the latter will often change the sentiment to admiring devotion. If the lady in peach-colored velvet and leopard skin had worn a pleasant expression in addition to her other elaborate furnishings, Emmeline, at least, might have respected and even loved her. As it was, she gave her a horrible reputation, based chiefly on a second-hand knowledge of gilded depravity derived from the conversation of those who were skilled in the art of novelette reading. Birch filled in a few damaging details from his own limited imagination. "She's a bad lot, that one is," declared Emmeline, after a long and friendly stare. "Her husband hates her." "He knocks her about," said Bert, with enthusiasm. "No, he don't, 'cause he's dead. She poisoned him slow and gradual so that nobody didn't know. Now she wants to marry a lord with heaps and heaps of money. He's got a wife already, but she's going to poison her, too." "She's a bad lot," said Bert, with growing hostility. "Her mother hates her, and she's afraid of her, too, because she's got a sarcastic tongue, always talking sarcasms, she is. She's greedy, too. If there's fish going, she eats her own share and her little girl's as well, though the little girl is delicate." "She had a little boy once," said Bert, "but she pushed him into the water when nobody wasn't looking." "No, she didn't," said Emmeline. "She sent him away to be kept by poor people so her husband wouldn't know where he was. They ill-treat him something cruel." "What's her name?" asked Bert, thinking that it was time that so interesting a personality should be labeled. "Her name?" said Emmeline, thinking hard. "Her name's Morvera." It was as near as she could get to the name of an adventuress who figured prominently in a cinema drama. There was silence for a moment while the possibilities of the name were turned over in the children's minds. "Those clothes she's got on ain't paid for and never won't be," said Emmeline. "She thinks she'll get the rich lord to pay for 'em, but he won't. He's given her jewels, hundreds of pounds worth." "He won't pay for the clothes," said Bert with conviction. Evidently there was some limit to the weak good nature of wealthy lords. At that moment, a motor carriage with liveried servants drew up at the emporium entrance. A large lady with a penetrating and rather hurried manner of talking stepped out, followed slowly and sulkily by a small boy who had a very black scowl on his face and a very white sailor suit over the rest of him. The lady was continuing an argument which had probably commenced in Portman Square. "Now, Victor, you are to come in and buy a nice doll for your cousin Bertha. She gave you a beautiful box of soldiers on your birthday, and you must give her a present on hers." "Bertha is a fat little fool," said Victor, in a voice that was as loud as his mother's and had more assurance in it. "Victor, you are not to say such things. Bertha is not a fool, and she is not in the least fat. You are to come in and choose a doll for her." The couple passed into the shop, out of view and hearing of the two backstreet children. "My, he is in a wicked temper," exclaimed Emmeline. But both she and Bert were inclined to side with him against the absent Bertha, who was doubtless as fat and foolish as he had described her to be. "I want to see some dolls," said the mother of Victor to the nearest assistant. "It's for a little girl of 11.
"A fat little girl of 11. Added Victor by way of supplementary information. "Victor, if you say such rude things about your cousin, you shall go to bed the moment we get home without having any tea."
"This is one of the newest things we have in dolls," said the assistant, removing a hobble-skirted figure in peach-colored velvet from the window. "Leopard skin toque and stole, the latest fashion. You won't get anything newer than that anywhere. It's an exclusive design."
"Look," whispered Emmeline outside, "they've been and took Morvera."
There was a mingling of excitement and a certain sense of bereavement in her mind. She would have liked to gaze at that embodiment of overdressed depravity for just a little longer.
"I expect she's going away in a carriage to marry the rich lord," hazarded Bert.
"She's up to no good," said Emmeline vaguely. Inside the shop, the purchase of the doll had been decided on. "It's a beautiful doll, and Bertha will be delighted with it," asserted the mother of Victor loudly.
"Oh, very well," said Victor sulkily. You needn't have it stuck into a box and wait an hour while it's being done up into a parcel. I'll take it as is, and we can go around to Manchester Square and give it to Bertha and get the thing done with. That will save me the trouble of writing for Dear Bertha with Victor's love on a bit of paper. Very well, said his mother. We can go to Manchester Square on our way home. You must wish her many happy returns of tomorrow and give her the doll. I won't let the little beast kiss me, stipulated Victor. His mother said nothing. Victor had not been half as troublesome as she had anticipated. When he chose, he could really be dreadfully naughty. Emmeline and Bert were just moving away from the window when Morvera made her exit from the shop. Very carefully, in Victor's arms, a look of sinister triumph seemed to glow in her hard, inquisitorial face. As for Victor, a certain scornful serenity had replaced the earlier scowls. He had evidently accepted defeat with a contemptuous good grace. The tall lady gave a direction to the footman and settled herself in the carriage. The little figure in the white sailor suit clambered in beside her, still carefully holding the elegantly garbed doll. The car had to be backed a few yards in the process of turning. Very stealthily, very gently, very mercilessly, Victor sent Morvera flying over his shoulder, so that she fell into the road just behind the retrogressing wheel. With a soft, pleasant-sounding scrunch, the car went over the prostrate form. Then it moved forward again with another scrunch. The carriage moved off and left Bert and Emmeline gazing in scared delight at a sorry mess of petrol-smeared velvet, sawdust, and leopard skin, what was all that remained of the hateful Morvera. They gave a shrill cheer and then raced away, shuddering from the scene of so much rapidly enacted tragedy. Later that afternoon, when they were engaged in the pursuit of minnows by the waterside in St. James's Park, Emmeline said in a solemn undertone to Bert, "I've been thinking. Do you know who he was? He was her little boy, what she sent away to live with poor folks. He come back and done that." I hope you enjoyed the author Saki's Morvera. This is Ms. G bringing you Telling Tales here at KTO 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. I'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. Hello there, this is Ms. G. I'm bringing you Telling Tales here tonight. And before I start with my next story, I wanted to make sure you knew that we're here to remind you to vote in today's primary election. You can tune into K2 tonight at 10 p.m. and 11 for election results from APRN.
Election results can also be viewed online at 360north.org. And speaking of stories, I wanted to let you know that First Folio, the book that gave us Shakespeare, is on tour from the Folger Shakespeare Library. It's going to be here till August 24th, and it is on display at the Father Andrew P. Kasher-Veroff State Library Archives and Museum. So check that out. And last but certainly not least, there's going to be venues of Shakespeare around town. And let's see. Tomorrow, Titus Andronicus is playing at the Rockwell Restaurant at 7 p.m. And we also have Merchant of Venice Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Valley Library. And Romeo and Juliet Fridays at the APK building at 7 p.m. So I believe these are readings, yes, of these wonderful stories. So if you're in the mood for more reading, check that out. Okay. So back to more storytelling here in the studio. I have an Ursula Wills Jones story titled The Time Sweepers. You may not be familiar with the time sweepers. The time sweepers are the people who sweep up all the time that is lost and wasted. You cannot see them. Though if you are in the railway station and think you see something out of the corner of your eye, that will probably be a time sweeper, cleaning up around the bench you were sitting on. If you were to see them, you would find a small bluish person with an intent expression, clutching a broom and a mop. The men wear overalls, the women old-fashioned tweed skirts and scarves on their head. The time sweepers are present wherever time is being lost or wasted. There are always several in train stations and at least one in every doctor's surgery. The man who has waited so long to propose to his girlfriend that her hair has gone gray probably has his own personal time sweeper following him around. The woman who has spent 35 loathe years in an estate agent's dreaming of opening a florist causes the neighborhood time sweeper to sigh and fetch a bigger dustpan. You should not feel sorry for the time sweepers, though their work is menial. They are never sick. Do not worry that they are in the wrong career and have excellent working conditions, though what they do for leisure is unknown. They enjoy bank holidays off, which is why on these days there seems so much more time than usual. At Christmas and New Year, the time sweepers have a week's holiday. When they return to work in January, they face a vast backlog of time which has been lost, wasted, and thrown away over the holidays. It takes them around 3 weeks to resume normal service, which is why January always seems to last longer than other months. The time sweepers have been around forever. Though modern life has created wasted time in such large concentrations that in some places, the time sweepers have been forced to industrialize their operations, buying a number of specialized compressing lorries similar to those used by ordinary bin men. They use these for the largest collections, at prisons and shopping malls, two venues where the tide of wasted time threatens to swamp even the most dedicated operatives. Were you to ask a time sweeper, they would tell you one surprising thing. Time enjoyed is never time wasted. Cleaning up in a large office full of staggering tedium, the time sweeper will pass straight by the desk of the woman who is reading a holiday catalog under the desk, poring over photos of tropical beaches. They will pass by the next desk where a man is enjoyably wondering what his mother-in-law looks like naked and stop by the desk of the young man who is counting every minute and loathing the hours. You may wonder what happens to the wasted time after it has all been cleaned up. Never fear, the time sweepers are ardent recyclers. It is collected, packed into large containers, moved to Liverpool docks, loaded onto a ship, and taken to India. There, in a dusty industrial estate somewhere near Bombay, it is clean, sorted, and graded. The most toxic and poisoned time, the residues of failed peace negotiations, wrongful imprisonments, and truly poisonous marriages, is skimmed off and buried in a tank underneath a disused army base. There, it will take 2 or 3 centuries to decay and become harmless again. The rest of the time, made up of stuff such as dull meetings, missed appointments, delayed buses, and bad nights at the theater, is cleaned and put back onto a ship, where it is taken to the Guangzhou Industrial Export Processing Zone. Here, it is compressed and stored, awaiting redistribution. Around 20% goes direct to the factories of the Export Processing Zone, which has the world's highest productivity rate. A quarter is bought in hard dollars by the Chinese government. 10% of the most concentrated stuff is sold to a cryogenics laboratory in California. Another 20% or so is discreetly sold to a variety of rich private clients, mostly old, rich men who have married beautiful young women. However, the time sweepers are not in it for profit. The money from these deals pays for their operations, including dusters, bin bags, overalls, and shipping. The rest is distributed to good causes. No one who gets any extra time has to fill in any forms or ask for a grant. They are all quite unaware that they are in a receipt of assistance. One of these beneficiaries is a shabby and overtired scientist in a crumbling public laboratory outside Novosibirsk, who will be the man to find the vaccine for malaria. Another is a prostitute in Nairobi's slum who has fostered 17 children and who, despite 20 years in the business, never falls ill. A third is the Indian tax driver in a cramped flat in Toronto who, in between sending money home to a sick wife and children, is writing what will later be acknowledged as the greatest novel of the century. Not all the recipients of the time sweepers' largesse are people. About 40 miles outside Timbuktu, a medieval mosque buried in sand receives a delivery every decade or so. Somewhere below the floor in the Aegean Sea, a Trojan galley is miraculously preserved in mud. Similarly, the time sweepers gift a little extra time to a temple in Mexico and preserve a haul of Dark Age treasure in a Galway bog. A certain amount of charitable time is kept back for emergency situations, both small and large. It is parachuted in times of desperation and has facilitated peace deals, changed battles, and allowed numerous fathers to make it to the delivery room in time. The time sweepers are, by their very nature, a tidy and orderly sort of people. They wish that humans would think more about throwing away this valuable commodity, but don't expect it'll happen anytime soon. There isn't a moral to this story. It's just that if you are planning on throwing away your time, please remember, somebody has to pick it up. That was The Time Sweepers by Ursula Wills Jones. This has been Telling Tales with Ms. G here at KTO 104.3 in Juneau, Alaska. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, good night.